Thank you very much from the Roybals. We had a Roybal and a Roybalette. That was very, very nice. I think it's very nice when we have families that, the families that play together stay together. Is that about right, Sharon? It was very, very nice. Today, I want to thank Mr. Brown for his very nice message. I do remember 221B. B? Whatever. It was late at night when I was over there, so I don't know what the number was. And I remember when he was going through the different houses and whatnot, and I said, you know, Washington's starting to look really, really good. But he has found out the most important thing to a homeowner. It almost as if it's a spiritual place once you're a homeowner. A place that all of us go. We go there to find relief, comfort, resource, solace. Home Depot. No, thank you, Mr. Brown. Today I'd like to revisit a subject with you that we began in August, or I began in August with you. It's a subject I think of such importance that with it, it can indeed change to a great degree the way we look at our spiritual walk. It is a highly defined concept in God's Word, but it is poorly understood. It occupies entire books, but it is often not put into practice, and often those books are the last to be read. And it is the idea of wisdom. We talked about that a month ago, and if you've been with the Bible studies, you would know that we've been going through it. Wisdom is the application of knowledge that God gives us. It is the application of the knowledge that God gives us. That is what wisdom is. Now, wisdom, in a general sense, can exist in many different forms. And you will have had experience with people who've had great wisdom in a given profession. In woodworking, I know a few people that are unbelievably gifted. They have wisdom in how to draw and execute, to cut out the different shapes of wood and put them together. Have any of you ever seen Mr. Herb Vieira's woodwork? He's technically a cabinet maker. If any of you have, a few of you have. It is unbelievable. It's really one of his talents that most people don't know about. You can have woodworking and have the arts and the music. Anytime I see someone play the piano, as we did for special music, I'm amazed. And wisdom can come from a number of different areas in our lives. I personally studied chemistry when I was young, and I was a bench chemist, something I share with a couple people in this room. And there were many, many good research and analytical chemists. They were brilliant in their field, and others, they were pretty bad. Me, I was pretty mediocre. I was right in the middle, tending toward the not so good. But those that were brilliant, those were the wise ones. They were usually, definitely, in the main, they were older. And they had this massive expanse of experience. There wasn't little that they hadn't seen or experienced themselves. It was the ability applying the knowledge they had. It was wisdom gained after years and years of life. Wisdom can also be acquired in conjunction with the experience coupled with God's gift. And we know, again, through the Bible study that we're going through and what we spoke about with each other back in July, Solomon is the epitome as the man most associated with God's gift of wisdom. In our study of Ecclesiastes, and if you have missed the Bible study, I cannot ask you strongly enough to just try out the Bible study. It's highly interactive. There's four of us that present it. And I think each of us, I was talking to Mr. Opichka before services, each of us have developed, I think, in one way or another, a greater understanding and a greater appreciation for this very difficult book, because it is so honest and it is so, some commentators say, raw, because it says everything. It tells about everything in life. We have spent currently, if I'm not mistaken, we have spent over 2 months. Is that right, Ward? Do you think so? Over 2 months, and we are barely three quarters of the way through the book. You should hear some of the interaction. They've been highly engaged, highly probative. People have asked some very interesting questions. We've discussed it together as God's Word, which Ecclesiastes is part of. This book, I believe, was written for two different groups of people, Ecclesiastes. First, it was written for those that are intensely curious. For you to investigate the book of Ecclesiastes, you have to have a highly, highly developed sense of curiosity, inquisitiveness. Why is this book there? What does it have to say? It's part of the canon, and it has been part of the canon for 1,000 or more years. This has always, always been an interest to God's people, this idea of what is the truth and the curiosity that comes with it. We want to know what the truth is, not just plain knowledge, but God's truth. This, as I say, has always been a hallmark of God's people, the desire, the willingness to know, and to know deep things, God's truth and God's deep things. Secondly, I believe it is written to those who have come to a place often where they indeed openly and honestly begin to question. They begin to question just about everything. It's mainly due to tragedy or conflict or some experience in their life, and they want to know for a completely different reason. They want to know, again, at a deeper level, the whys and the wherefores. What is God doing? Why is he doing it? How does he act? Why is there sometimes no meaning to this? And I believe the book of Ecclesiastes gives this. And many of us, in one way or another, have experienced, and as I look across the room and I think of all the people that we elders and deacons talk about, there have been people that have gone through some deep, deep conflicts and tragedies. Not that their faith is shattered at all, but the tragedies or the conflicts or the upheaval in our lives, they have occurred. They have occurred. Many have and are, to one degree or another, they are suffering. So they ask the second group, what is God doing? But it is in the experience of a life. And there are many dozens and dozens of lives here today. Whether you are 18 or 8 or 108, it's in the experiences of a life. Those experiences shape us. The things that we go through from our childhood into our teenage years into young adulthood and all the way into adulthood and beyond, those experiences shape you. When I do financial counseling, I will listen to people. I ask lots and lots of questions. Ask my kids. They are sick and tired of my questions. I ask questions. When I ask them questions, I listen to them as much as possible. And 99 times out of 100, the way people think about finances were the way they were raised by their parents. In fact, all of you think of finances because of your mother or your father or the adults in your life when you were young. It shapes you and it changes you for the rest of your life. And believe it or not, those experiences will never leave you. They will always follow you the rest of your life. And so it is in the experience of life, no matter how old you are, we are shaped. But it is when we apply God's knowledge to those lives and those experiences that wisdom is developed. And so, as the first speaker said, you want a title? He had one. I ain't got one. Except we'll call it Sophos 2, Wisdom Number 2. Catchy, huh? Wisdom is what most people want. They spend their life trying to acquire it or attempting to. It's interesting when wisdom is given, isn't it? I think we would agree. Wisdom, when given, seems to be to the person receiving it, when they say this is wisdom, they think it is often outrageously brilliant. Right? That's brilliant what that person said. It's amazing. It's amazing. The recipient is often surprised by its brilliance. And then they say often, it seems so simple. Why didn't I? What? Think of it. I must not be wise. This person thought of it. So it's also brilliantly simple and rather obvious, almost profoundly so. They ponder it when they receive wisdom, when all of us do, and it answers a question. But most people feel that wisdom is an external thing, never internal. It's always someone else that has wisdom, that we really don't have any innate wisdom. It's always in the church. It's always, wisdom is always given to the elders. I don't want to break your bubble today, but you can probably figure out what most of us would say. We are not the sole repository of wisdom, as shocking as that may be. But most people feel that wisdom to them is always with someone else. It always belongs somewhere else. Wisdom, we know, ultimately does come from God. And so, since it is from Him, wisdom tells us why we do the things we do. We understand the things that we do because God gives us the wisdom. It should give us answers, shouldn't it? If we believe that God's word is inspired and we read that word and we truly understand it and we apply it, it should give us answers, deep answers. As we read the verses that we will today, I want you to ponder their deeper meanings. And in reading, we'll hopefully learn something else. Hopefully, we'll learn something internal as well. Let's start with Solomon just as a recap. I want you to turn with, if you would please, to 1 Kings chapter 4 as a kind of a running start on Solomon. Solomon was given truly a massive amount of knowledge. And I think sometimes we really don't understand the depth and the scope of his knowledge. So in 1 Kings chapter 4, in verse 29, it says, "And God gave Solomon wisdom and exceedingly great understanding and largeness of heart like the sand on the seashore." That's pretty expansive, right? Sand of the seashore. Abraham was to be blessed with as many descendants as the sands of the seashore. So this is Solomon's wisdom. "As the sand of the seashore," verse 30, "thus Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the men of the east." It does admit they had wisdom, but Solomon's wisdom was greater than all the wisdom of the east, all the wisdom of Egypt. "For he was wiser than all men, than Ethan the Ezrahite, and Heman, and Chalcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahol. And his fame was in all the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs. We have a small, small portion. And his songs were 1,005. I always thought that was interesting. 1,005. And he spoke of trees and from cedar tree of Lebanon. He was a botanist. Even to the hyssop that springs out of the wall. He spoke also of animals and of birds, of creeping things and of fish. And men of all nations from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom came to hear the wisdom of Solomon." We're talking here about a lot of knowledge. Tremendous. He could speak on just about anything. Well, we have met people, I'm sure you have, or heard about people, who they know a little about everything. He knew a lot about everything because God had given him this type of wisdom and this depth. In chapter 10, verse 14, 1 Kings, if you'll turn there, please. It continues with the description of Solomon. It says in verse 14 of chapter 10 of 1 Kings, "The weight of gold that came to Solomon yearly was 666 talents of gold." They estimate that is between $500 and $800 million a year. They estimate that he was worth between $200 and $400 billion in today's dollars. Besides that, verse 15, "From the traveling merchants, from the income of traders, from all the kings of Arabia, and from the governors of the country." This guy, we'd say, was filthy rich. And King Solomon made 200 large shields of hammered gold. 600 shekels of gold went into each shield. He also made 300 shields of hammered gold. 3 minas of gold went into each shield. The king put them in the house of the forest of Lebanon, which we have no record of whatsoever. We have no idea where these went. "Moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with pure gold. The throne had 6 steps, and the top of the throne was round at the back. There were armrests on either side, and 2 lions stood beside the armrests. 12 lions stood there, 1 on each side of the 6 steps. Nothing like this had been for any other kingdom. All King Solomon's drinking vessels were gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. Not one was silver, for this was accounted as nothing in the days of Solomon." He was rich. Unbelievably rich. He had knowledge and he had riches not like any other one. But God is the one that gave it to him. God is the one that bestowed on Solomon. When he asked for wisdom, God said, if you'll remember in the prayer, He said, because you did not ask for wealth, you did not ask for the death of your enemies, I will give you wealth like any other human being that has ever lived. And he did. And now we enter the book of Ecclesiastes. Turn with me, if you would, to chapter 2. We are not going to do a running commentary on the book of Ecclesiastes, but I've taken a few source scriptures to give you an idea of the journal of this man, because I feel what he is saying to us, to the church, is so profound, we need to listen. In Ecclesiastes chapter 2, and in verse 1, he said, I said in my heart, I want you to look at the word I, me, and my, and mine, in just these few short verses. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure. But surely this was also vanity. I said of laughter, madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine, while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the sons of man to do under all the days of their lives. He's saying, I tried it all. I tried women. I tried wine. Nothing in and of themselves bad about those two things, but he did them to excess. He says, verse 4, I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants. I had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kinds. Every type of pleasure, every type of human endeavor, everything that man could get, Solomon acquired. And he says, I did all this. I acquired all this. He indeed had it all. George Frederick Owen, in his book, From Abraham to Middle East Crisis, says, all of Solomon's drinking vessels were gold, and those of his house were pure gold. The shields of his mighty men were made of beaten gold, and his great throne was made of ivory and overlaid with finest gold. Silver in Jerusalem became as common as stones. Solomon literally built himself a paradise of pleasure. One of his chief resorts was Etham, where, when the mornings were beautiful, he often went in stately progress, dressed in snow-white raiment, riding in his chariot of state, which was made of the finest cedar, decked with gold and silver and purple, and carpeted with the costliest tapestries worked by the daughters of Jerusalem, and attended by bodyguards of 60 valiant men, of the tallest and handsomest of the young men of Israel, arrayed in Tyrian purple, with their long black hair freshly sprinkled with gold dust, every day glittering in the sun. No one before and no one since has ever lived like this. This was Solomon's world, and he felt that he had created it, that he had given it to himself. Picture it. There was nothing he could not have. When we think at the supermarket, when the checkout lane, very rarely do I get to go to the supermarket. Becky trusts me with just a very short item, a list of things, because she knows I'll become very defocused. And so when I go through the checkout line with 15 things instead of the three she asked me to bring, I will look at all the periodicals about this rock star's wedding or this movie star's party or Oprah flying 15 to 20 people in her private jet to the Sultan of Brunei, and on it goes. And we think, wow, unbelievable. They spent $3 million on their wedding or $5 million on this party. Solomon's would dwarf these parties. Solomon's parties, Solomon's, I don't know how many weddings he had. He had hundreds and hundreds of wives. Can you imagine the weddings he had? First of all, it was, oh no, not another wedding, right? but it was Solomon's wedding, and so it was big. This is the world that he lived in. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll, we would say. He experienced it all. All of it. All that he had acquired, he attributed to himself. He had now acquired it. He had now built it. He had developed a self-absorbed, regal arrogance. It is a journal. This book isn't Ecclesiastes. It is a journal of futility. But Solomon, you didn't build it. God built it. In verse 11, he says something. He says, "Then I looked on all my works of my hands had done, and all the labor which I had troubled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping for the wind. It was air. It was nothing. There was no profit under the sun," meaning there was no point to it. Would that Hollywood, would that the world read this book. In fact, many of the commentators feel, one preacher that I read one of his commentaries said, if he was to read to the world, to the unconverted, he would read from the book of Ecclesiastes. That is the broad breadth of this book. It speaks to so many different people. But Solomon says, after all of this, there was nothing. It was a grasping of the wind, of the air. It was empty. It was futile. It was vanity. Wealth and riches and power and prestige means nothing. You can only drive so many Rolls Royces at one time. You can eat only so many steaks at one time. And Solomon had Rolls Royces and steaks and houses. What if you lived in Beverly Hills? I was trying to have a good analogy. What if Solomon lived in Beverly Hills, to give it to Southern California spin? It would be as if he owned every home in Beverly Hills and kept his horses in Bel Air. That's how powerful Solomon was. And he said, it's futile. Now, what you're thinking right now, oi, let me try some of that futility for 20 to 30 years. But what's interesting is that Solomon is trying to convey some wisdom. And he takes in the book of Ecclesiastes through chapters 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. And we struggled with these chapters. And many of the brethren, in asking their questions, this sounds like almost heresy, some of these things. All die, all go to the one place. There is no remembrance in the grave after one dies. This is horrible. This is depressing. Why would God put this in his word? But when we take snapshots of a book that God's writing, especially Ecclesiastes, because it is a journal, it's kind of like walking into the movie halfway through it. You don't know what went before. You don't understand the buildup, the reasons behind it. You don't understand the story. Because in chapter 7 of Ecclesiastes, there is a massive switch that has been thrown. I'd like you to turn there if you would. We just completed chapter 7. I didn't get to do it. I would love to have done it. It is a fabulous, fabulous set of verses. But I was fascinated to hear the Bible study of the person who did give it. It is truly interesting, and we're going to spend the bulk of our remaining time in this chapter. The switch is thrown, and Solomon in his journal turns a corner. It's as if we're reading his inner thoughts from chapter 1 through 6. Vanity, futility. All that I've acquired means nothing. He says it is a grasping of the wind, a grasping of air. It's vanity. It's futility. He says, I had struggles you can't imagine. He says, I had struggles. You had struggles? I had struggles you can't even fathom, Solomon says. And here we have a man with massive experience unlike any other natural man. Jesus said up until Jesus' day, because a greater than Solomon now lived in Jesus Christ. Look it up. Up until Jesus Christ, there had never been a greater in terms of wisdom. Massive experience, unlike any natural man before or after. And who is he writing to? And who is he speaking to in the book of Ecclesiastes? He's speaking to us. He's speaking to people who will listen. In the writing of Proverbs, there are three types of Proverbs. You might want to listen for them. They're literary styles. You might want to listen to each type of proverb. There is the contrasting proverb, which means when you see the word nevertheless, but even so, contrast one with another. Nevertheless, the completive or completive, it says the word similar, and then even. Even this is a good thing, so it's completive. And then there's comparative. Well, this is good, but better is this. This is good, but this is what we want. And so you'll see these three types of very precise, wise proverbs here. Let's begin in 1a, chapter 7, verse 1a. It says, a good name is better than precious ointment. Stop. A good name is better than precious ointment. If any verse was written to Americans, if any verse was written to Southern Californians, it's this verse. Why? Gucci, Chanel, Ralph Lauren, he says, ain't it. A good name is. We live in the world of Rodeo Drive. How many of you have been on Rodeo Drive? Oh, wow. Well, better yet, how many of you haven't been on Rodeo Drive? Yeah. The three of you can all go together. It's unbelievable, isn't it? It's truly unbelievable. Gucci, Chanel, Ralph Lauren ain't it, Solomon says. And he ought to know. He says a good name is. He says it is your reputation that is important, not your handbag, not your perfume, not your car. It's your name. It is not what, he says, but who you are. The things that we have and the things that we do not define us. It's not where you live. And I used to live in Glendora. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. It isn't Beverly Hills that makes you important. It's not where you live that makes you important, but how you live. Young people, listen, because I know we have some visitors today. Is it wrong to wear designer stuff? Not at all. I've been known to go to the Cabazon outlet, by the way, occasionally. It's not wrong to wear these things. It is not wrong to have these things. And that's not what Solomon is saying at all. He just says it's better to have a good reputation. It is better to have or to be known for a good name. Because unfortunately, or fortunately, the Gucci's and the Chanel's, they do wear out. It's always the next fashion, or it's the next statement, right? It's the thing that we want that week. Ooh, that suit of clothes, that's beautiful. Oh, but the one I have is 3 years old. Ooh, same designer, but this is newer, this is better. I need that. Or I have this beautiful exotic car, but it's 4 years old. The ashtrays are full. That was the old joke. The gas tank is empty. I need a new one. It's not what we have. It's who we are, he says very clearly. A good name is better than precious ointment. So is it wrong to wear designer stuff? Is it wrong to have a brand new, very, very nice car? Absolutely not. But it is wrong if you can't afford it. And that's as an advisor. It's wrong if you can't afford it. And it's wrong if you think it makes you who you are. Because it doesn't. It's temporary. It's fun. As we'll see later, Solomon says very clearly, whatever you have, whether it be great or small, wonderful or not so wonderful, to enjoy it. Because it is what is inside that counts, not outside. And that's just verse 1a. B says, shockingly, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. Let me rephrase it. Better is the day of death than the day of one's birth. Better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For that is the end of all men, and all the living will take it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter. A sad countenance is better, and the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. What does that mean? What can that, talk about negative. that seemingly sounds very, very negative. But let me stop you for a minute. There are points in all our lives, you've experienced them no matter how young you are or how old you are. There are points in your life that cause us to stop and be aware. How many of you have ever saw, this is going to really date me, how many of you ever saw the movie, It's a Mad, 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 people, hands are going up before I finish the title. Right, how many of you have seen that movie? Yeah, quite a few of you. It's kind of like, I mean, for those under 50, let me explain to you about this movie. It's a good movie. It's okay for kids. My mom took 15 Cub Scouts to go see it. Scarred me for life, but no, it's a good movie. They were looking for the big W. Nobody knew what the big W was, but that's where the treasure was. That's where all the money was. And those of you that saw it, I can see you smiling. And as they went to Santa Monica, that's where it was filmed, it was palm trees and the big W. And you could see them looking around, and the W was right behind them, 50 feet in the air. And all of a sudden, they turned around, and they said, whoa, whoa, this is it. This is the place. This is what he was talking about. It's like an aha moment. It's where you kind of dummy up. You're sat bolt upright, and you say to yourself, this is important. I'm not sure what it means, but it's got to mean something. One came to me recently. In fact, it was 2 or 3 weeks in the making. We went to a memorial of someone who had died. We would call that, in the words of Ecclesiastes, the house of mourning. Yes, we're there in all memorials, and we've had them in these buildings many, many times. There to celebrate life and to remember and to see old friends, and that's important. But in this case, and it was last Sabbath in the evening, it was Ken's lab. We were not there to meet Mr. Slab. Mr. Slab was dead, and so we mourned. Old and young alike, and many, many young people were there. Many, many of you were there. And verses 2 through 4 was the big W for me. I said, we're in the house of mourning. Or I'm going to be. I knew I was going to be there. I was planning to attend. Becky and I were. I said, we're going to be in the house of mourning. We will not be in the house of laughter. There will be some smiles and reminiscings, no doubt. But it says, not to be maudlin. And I'm not saying to hang around funeral homes or to show up to memorials or cemeteries of people you don't know. But what I am saying to you, when you're in the house of mourning, you are paused to think, to stop and reflect. And that is exactly what these verses mean. And for those of us, and most of us did, either knew of or heard of Mr. Slab or went to the memorial, it says, better to go to the house of mourning to the house of feasting. When Solomon says the house of feasting, he is not talking about the clinking of martini glasses at a function, or even the Feast of Tabernacles, or a potluck at your house. He's talking about a debauched, reckless feast. That's what he's talking about. Remember, this is Solomon talking. He's saying it is better to go to the house of mourning, for this is the end of all men. The living shall take it to heart. The living shall take it to heart. When you go to a memorial, when you go to a funeral, the person in question is dead. So he therefore says the living should take it to heart. It's important. It's very important. Why is important? It reminds us. It sobers us. We have wonderful reflections of the person that we knew that is no longer. But we think of eternal things. And Solomon says elsewhere in the book of Ecclesiastes, he puts the eternal things in our heart. We call to mind the understanding that we have that in death, which we will all face in this room, that we sleep and we await a resurrection. Is sorrow better than laughter? Is it better than feasting? Solomon uses it as a contrast. He doesn't say one is wrong. He says one is much better. And so indeed, I did think a lot more differently than I have. And I've been to many, many, as you have, many, many funerals, many, many memorials. So when he gives us this teachable moment, he is comparing this riotous living of the world with a very sobering, deep reflection of a memorial service. It's important. It's important that we take these moments that God gives us and says, wait a minute, is this a big W moment? Is this an aha moment? Is this God's trying to teach me? And sometimes God will knock us flat on our backs, won't he, to get us to look up and remember. Verses 5 through 6 have another set of ideas. He says, it is better, so this is that comparative, it is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. For like the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is vanity. Surely oppression destroys a wise man's reason, and a bribe debases the heart. Let's focus on 5:6. The song of fools. No one, brethren, appreciates in this room more than I a good joke. We all like good stories, a joke said well, or a story said well. But comparatively, it says, it is like the thorns in a fire. When you build a fire, and I built one yesterday, I built a fire yesterday afternoon, we have this fire pit, and I had some stuff I wanted, some old wood, and I put some very, very light wood. So I built a fire yesterday afternoon, and the kids came out, and, Dad, why are you building a fire again? I think it's one of the reasons my youngest son wishes to be a paramedic firefighter. His father's a pyromaniac. But as the lighter stuff began to burn, it crackles and it pops. What's the reference here? It says, it is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. For the crackling of thorns under a pot is the laughter of a fool. If you're going to build a fire and you build it out of thorns, you're going to have a bad fire. It ain't going to last very long. It crackles, it pops, and it's gone. You need to have a large log, larger pieces of wood to keep that fire going. Substance. And that is exactly what he is saying here. Everyone loves to laugh. But he says it is better to hear the rebuke of the wise. What's the rebuke of the wise? Each and every one of us has had people in our lives that have rebuked us. I've had quite a few. When I receive a rebuke, I'm not sure about you, I'm not the most receptive individual. It's a rebuke. People can praise you or they can rebuke you. How many would rather be rebuked than praised? A couple of you will talk to you afterwards. Most of us would rather be praised. That's not what this verse says. It says it is better to hear the rebuke of the wise. One of the abilities that we have with God's Spirit is to understand when we dare hear the rebuke of someone who is wise. And I've had those people in my life. Unfortunately, I didn't always listen to them. It was only later that wisdom is defined. And we say then, I should have listened to him. I should have listened to her. I should have listened to them. Because they were speaking wisdom. I took it for harm. God meant it for good. And so it's important. The rebuke of the wise, it is better to hear than for a man to hear the song of fools. In many ways, the contrast is, if you want to be praised, it's like the crackling of thorns. It won't last. Many times in our life, we will not remember the people who praise us. We won't remember their good thoughts. Oh, what a wonderful job you did. You're quite a guy. You're quite a gal. What a wonderful job. You don't remember those. Our memories are so bad, we have to have plaques and awards to remind ourselves of our accomplishments. Well, I remember that, 1998. I was pretty hot then. I don't remember what this was for, but it looked good. But we often remember the rebuke of the wise. Where someone had occasion, you thought for wrong, and they tore you up pretty good. And on reflection, you remember that. It's typically a parent or a coach. Hopefully not too often it's an elder. As I said, wisdom does not equal elder. But those rebukes that we do receive are often very, very important. And by the way, they can come from an elder, so I'm not discounting us at all. Wisdom can come from many, many sources in many, many different situations. There was no individual last week in the memorial that gave me this idea or this concept. It was an event. And these words in chapter 7 put the two together. And so it can come from many, many different sources. And we listen to this because it is indeed wisdom. What's interesting is that verse 7 talks about something that is so common in our day, we can't count any longer the times it has happened. Surely oppression destroys a man's reason, and a bribe debases the heart. There's nothing worse than someone in honor and authority that has been bribed, or does something deceitful, does something wrong. It needs very little commentary. Verses 8 through 10, and I'll warn you ahead of time, we are not going through the entire chapter. A big sigh of relief, I know, to many. In verse 8, it says, "The end of a thing is better than its beginning. The patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Do not hasten in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of our old friend, the fool. Do not say, 'Why were the former days better than these?' For you do not inquire wisely concerning this." There's a lot there. It has to do with one aspect more than another. It has to do with time and the passage of time that each of us, every one of us, go through. The end is better. Now, he says, show patience. What about the former days? Brethren, why do we long for the former days? Oh, I wish it was 19-something or other. Why do we do that? Because in our mind, we have said, why were the former days better than these? These days suck. I want it 30 years ago, when I was younger, when I could move and do things a lot better than I can now. Why do we do that? Those of us who do long, do we recall all of the past? When we think of a time that we would rather go back to in some strange spiritual time machine, many of us think we can. Do we remember all of it? Do we remember all of the days of the past, as Solomon hints at? Do we remember the tragedy that we endured? Do we remember the very negative things? No. We push those out of our minds. He does indeed say, why were the former days better than these? For you do not inquire wisely concerning this. Why? Because your memory is highly, I know mine is, highly selective. I thought about this, about why many of us long for the old days, whatever they may be. It could be a different year, a different time. It doesn't matter how old you are. You know, those that are 18 wishes they were 12. Those of us that are 35 wish we were 18. The 50-year-olds wish they were 35. And on and on and on. So I pondered this. Recently, because of the internet the last few years, and you're familiar with Ancestry.com, I began to do some research on my parents. I have a very rare spelling of my last name. And so there's not much out there. And most of the people that I could go to, including my parents, all my grandparents, all my aunts and uncles, are all very, very, very dead. And so it's really difficult to ask them questions. My sister and I, we talked this week, and she said, John, why were we interested in all this 20, 30 years ago? And I said, well, probably the same reason my kids aren't interested in it. You're too young. You don't appreciate it until you're older. And so because of the internet, my name pops up a little bit more, and I every once in a while do a search on Ancestry.com. They have a free service, and I'm cheap. And it doesn't take too long for me to hunt for my name. I'm done in 5 minutes. I can't imagine if your last name was Smith or Jones, where there are thousands. If I have one or two hits, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. We thought at one time there were only four of us male with my last name in the country. We now know there's 40. I know, not a lot to you, but that's a lot to us. But one of the things I did is I checked out what my dad had done in the mid-30s in Los Angeles, and there was a raceway that none of you have probably ever heard of called Ascot Legion Raceway, and it burned down in 1936. And my older parent, my father and uncles and whatnot, they were involved in racing, would reminisce, but they wouldn't reminisce too long. They'd trail off, and they were way well into their 70s and 80s. And I got to understand a little bit more as I did a lot of the research. And there was a lot of the thrill of the speed and the pits, and they were both owners and mechanics. But because of this, they won a lot of races, and they were very, very good for a period of time. But many of them were killed. Many drivers were lost. Some 24 men, all in their 20s, were killed in the space of about 12 years. And that's probably, I guess, or I imagine, why my dad was happy to have gone through those days, but he didn't want to go back to them. Because he did remember both the good and the not so good. So indeed, Solomon says, why do you say of the former days? Because this is where God has placed us. He has placed you and me here and now. As Jesus said, you cannot replace one hair on your head. You cannot make yourself short or tall. By extension, you cannot add a year. You cannot subtract a year. You cannot go forward. You cannot speed it up. And you cannot go into the past. And there is a reason. He says you're to enjoy now and where God has placed you and to gain the wisdom and experience. I was asked recently, would you like to be 35 again? I said, no, I wouldn't. But I would like the wisdom and experience at 35. That's the condition. If I can go back to 35 with the wisdom and experience, what little or great I have, maybe. But even then, I don't want to go through it again. And I think that's what God is telling us, to enjoy and to understand right now, with all the wisdom He has given us. We can read now the rest of these verses with a little bit more depth and understanding as we use God's Spirit. He says, wisdom, verse 11, is good for an inheritance and profitable to those who see the sun. For wisdom is a defense as money is a defense. Money's good. He didn't say money was bad. He says, but the excellence of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to those who have it. Money does not give life. This is Solomon speaking to us. Young people, listen. Having $20 million will not make your life perfect. It will not. We can make all the jokes. We can make all the funny stories. He's saying it will not give you life. The excellence of the knowledge and wisdom will. Verse 13. This is a couplet. He says, consider, see, as it is in the original Hebrew. See the work of God who can make straight, who can make straight what He, God, has made crooked. In the day of prosperity, be joyful, but in the day of adversity, consider, that word again, look. Surely God has appointed the one, the adversity as well as the prosperity, God has appointed the one as well as the other, so that man can find out nothing that will come after him. This is so profound. Who can make straight what God has made crooked? The words are, I don't know if they're meant to be cynical, sarcastic. Most of us would like to change those things that God has done because we think they're pretty crooked, right? God blew it over here. I need to make this straight, right? Unbend what He has done. We think it's bent or crooked. We'll make it straight. We'll, in other words, make it right. He says, who can do this? And here is where He subtly tells us about God, and He does this so often. You cannot make things straight that God has made the way He has because they look bent to you. So those who feel this book leaves out God, God underpins everything He says, especially from these chapters on. What do these verses, this chapter, the books of wisdom and the Proverbs that we hear? Well, it tells us, as we said in the first message a month ago, turn with me, if you would, to Proverbs chapter 2. Proverbs chapter 2. It says, my son, if you receive my words and treasure my commands within you, so that you incline your ear to wisdom and apply your heart to understanding. It says something very subtle, and the Bible does this quite often. These verses, Proverbs especially, and Ecclesiastes in the book of Proverbs, when you read them, they are speaking to you internally, not externally. Proverbs do not tell you what other people should do. Proverbs tell you and give wisdom to you. Give them internally. They do not address what others are to think. They are addressing what you are to think, what you are to do, what you ought to do so that your reputation is better than any perfume. It is internal because you cannot clean the outside, therefore other people, until you clean the inside. Until wisdom is garnered on the inside, don't dispense it to others. It is more important to take care of the inside. Proverbs and wisdom speaks to us, and I encourage you to join us for the Bible study, as I said, but even more than that, I encourage you to read the rest of the book of Ecclesiastes. It talks about life and the struggles that life has, but also the wonderful, glorious things that God has given us that we are to enjoy now and to be grateful for them, whatever situation we are in. Paul says, no matter what strait I find myself, I have found myself to be content. Though I wish to be with God, he says, I need to be here. I wish to be here. And so this is what it tells us, to apply wisdom, gain wisdom. Proverbs and Ecclesiastes tells us often to keep our ears open and our mouths closed. Ears open, mouths closed. So that we can indeed surround ourselves with wisdom, especially as it comes from God and His Word. Then we can apply it. For you see, Proverbs and Ecclesiastes speaks to us like a father. Either the father you never had, the father you did have, or the father you should have had. That's what Proverbs speaks to us. It says to listen, my son, my daughter, listen. Because indeed it is not Solomon who speaks to us. It's not the book of Ecclesiastes that speaks to us. It's really not the book of Proverbs that speaks to us. It's God who's speaking to us. Wisdom is gained from only one source, and that is God.